From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court was put in jeopardy when a letter alleging a sexual assault 36 years ago was revealed. The bombshell accusation has delayed the confirmation vote as the Senate and the White House grapple with how and when to go forward. The United States imposed tariffs of $200 billion worth of Chinese goods that will take effect in September of this year as the world's two largest economies continued their economic trade battle. In a remarkable development on the Korean Peninsula, South Korean President Moon Jae-in announced in a joint press conference with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un that North Korea would close a key missile test facility in the presence of international experts and potentially destroy its primary nuclear complex if the United States agrees to corresponding measures. And the leaders of Turkey and Russia said on Monday they had agreed to create a demilitarized buffer zone in Syria's Idlib province to separate Syrian government troops from rebel forces, with Turkish and Russian soldiers patrolling the zone to ensure it's respected. So, panelists, let's start with, of course, the Kavanaugh hearings. This is going, my feeling, honestly, is something that's going from bad to worse. I really lament how this thing has gone so far. And these accusations of an alleged sexual assault between Brett Kavanaugh and a woman when both were teenagers during his time in prep school here in Washington, D.C., has really just thrown a big monkey wrench in what was already kind of a fouled up procedure. Linda, I'm going to start with you. Where do we stand there? Where do these accusations come from? Who is the accuser, and how did it come to light?
So the accuser is a woman named Christine Blasey Ford, who is a psychology professor in California, a PhD, respected in her field. She was at a different prep school, a girls' prep school, back in the early 80s when Brett Kavanaugh was at Georgetown Prep. They were at a party, allegedly, and he allegedly was drunk and sexually attacked her. Didn't rape her, but seemingly tried to in her telling. This is something that she had conveyed in a confidential memo. It was given to Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee. This was kept confidential until right before the confirmation hearings were to begin, and thus was launched this epic battle over what to do. And this brought back echoes of 27 years ago when Clarence Thomas was nominated to the Supreme Court, and he faced last-minute accusations of sexual harassment from Anita Hill. I was in the hearing room for that.
The Anita Hill hearings.
For the Anita Hill hearings. And so I'm having flashbacks about this and really have mixed feelings about the whole thing. I mean, as a woman, I feel for Christine Blasey Ford. I think the impulse among a lot of women is to believe her, although there's no, she can't present any actual evidence so many years later. But I also feel that Brett Kavanaugh also needs to be treated fairly. So they're having this terrible dilemma within the committee about how to handle it. Ford, the woman, has tried to exert some leverage and dictate the terms of her appearance before the committee, but that's actually not how it works. The committee, the Judiciary Committee, is in charge here, and it was looking as if she was not going to testify. She was unwilling to testify under their terms, but now it was looking like Kavanaugh was going to speak again before the committee and talk about his side of the story without her side of the story. Right. And that I think would have ensured his confirmation. So as we speak, the terms of dual testimony, potentially both Ms. Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh are being determined. And I think the hope is that she will testify, he will be allowed to respond, and then the members of the committee can take it from there. And I have to say one more thing. All the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee are white men. And that brings another flashback back to 1991, when Anita Hill faced that same tableau. We have four women on the Democratic side, which helps, but for Republicans, this is terrible optics right before the midterms,
right,
of having all these men questioning a woman who talks about a very traumatic experience from years ago.
Steve, there's so much to talk about and so many ways to do this. I have a list of questions, but I think it's best to allow you to sort of dive into this and insert yourself into this conversation wherever you would like to. What's your take on what's going on right now?
Well, it's a remarkable situation because this was, first of all, the Supreme Court nomination is maybe the highest stakes political sort of game, for lack of a better word, we have in the United States. There are no higher stakes.
Exactly. When we talk about being fair to both right. sides in a process that has proved itself to specialize in the exact opposite, that seems to me to be the difficult situation here.
And even beyond that, Kavanaugh was cruising mm-hmm. toward confirmation. Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't have won by that many votes, but he would have easily yeah. been confirmed. And so that whole situation is now up in the air. And it does, I mean, there are questions really on every side, from Kavanaugh's response, which is to say, I mean, not it's a total denial mm-hmm. of anything remotely like that. He said he doesn't even know her, wasn't aware of this at all, you know, to her recollection, which is considerably different. The one interesting thing about on the Republican side is they have been talking about maybe having some of their staffers do the questioning, their female staffers,
yes.
you know, precisely to get at these optics issues. And yeah, I haven't seen anything like it again since Anita Hill. Yeah.
Since Anita Hill, which are called the Anita Hill hearings somehow and not the Clarence Thomas yeah. hearings. That's how important that one witness was. The FBI, it's almost difficult to talk about any subject in Washington now without an FBI investigation coming up in some way, shape, or fashion. And it is a presence here. The witness, Dr. Ford, has asked for a FBI investigation of this prior to, and I believe that request still stands mm-hmm. as a precondition for testifying. My question is this: why Brett Kavanaugh has been vetted many times mm-hmm. by the FBI for mm-hmm. previous positions that he has taken. Why hasn't this come out before? And what would the FBI find now on this investigation?
Well, it didn't come out before because Christine Blasey Ford chose not to reveal her story. And as for what the FBI could find if they were to reopen their investigation into Judge Kavanaugh, it's hard to imagine. They could try to track down the people who were at that party. Some women have stepped forward. I'm not sure that they're real witnesses. There is another witness who Ms. Blasey Ford says was in the room when Kavanaugh was attacking her. She would like him to testify. The problem with this other person, Mark Judge, is that he describes himself as having been a blackout drunk in high school. And he's even written a book about his struggle with alcoholism. So he's not the best witness in the world. And furthermore, Mark Judge has said he will not testify. So it's really a he said, she said. And 35 years later, I mean, who among us remembers parties that we attended in high school? You know, if you're Christine Blasey Ford and you say you've experienced this terrible attack, you remember that. You know, under normal circumstances, the parties are just a vague memory.
It really is. And I think I've heard people say there's a possibility that both of them could be right. That,
yes.
That, yes, this happened. And yes, I, Brett Kavanaugh, do not remember
it. Do not remember.
But,
which potentially suggests that he did this more than once. I mean, if...
Which is where I'm going.
Which is a terrible thing. If that was his standard behavior in high school.
This is exactly where I'm going. We're talking about him cruising to nomination or to confirmation a week ago. Now we have a roadblock here. We still have Republicans standing firm behind this candidate. Mm-hmm. I think that the pressure to me politically is on there are 23 women senators mm-hmm. in Congress mm-hmm. or in the Senate,
yes.
I believe, 23, six of them Republican.
Right.
A lot of pressure on how they will vote on a full vote if it, in fact, get out of committee. What can actually derail this? I say it's only a pattern. If another witness comes forward, if there's a pattern that's established, that derails it for sure.
I think it's actually smaller than that. I think if there's any way, and who knows how this can be shown, but that he was even at the same party with Dr. Ford, given how strongly he's denied it, then I think you really start to wonder about, you know, his credibility. Mm-hmm. There was also this crazy notion that some Republicans have put forward that perhaps somebody who looked like Kavanaugh was responsible. And if I think if Judge Kavanaugh can be tied to that effort, I also think that's highly problematic that if that was the case. So I think that it's actually more than that, whether that there's a pattern or not. It's also the issue of Kavanaugh's credibility. And it's really hanging in the balance. And I also think that it, whatever happens, Kavanaugh would withdraw his nomination if it's at all in doubt. So it's either, if they have a vote, it means it's going to happen.
It's going to go right through. Well, we do know that this is still a fluid situation, even as we speak. I'm sure we'll be covering it in coming days and weeks ahead. But it is something that makes me personally sort of lament for the process. Yeah. I sort of hate to see governance by investigation and scandal. And it seems that that's hard to escape here in Washington these days. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back with more Issues in the News.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download a podcast of the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Also, you can visit the program on Facebook and leave a comment or two while you're there. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. U.S.-China trade relations, I sort of have a standing paragraph. I do notes for this show, and the subjects change from week to week, but there's one that I don't erase. I simply modify, which is this paragraph on U.S. trade relations and the tariff battle that's going back and forth between the two largest economies in the world. So glad to have you here, Steve, and in-depth background on this. So could you sort of lay out what's happened? Like, go back sort of to the beginning of the year and where the genesis of this battle is and where it stands right now.
Well, I think the genesis goes back much even further than this year. It's the Trump campaign, where the issue of trade, and specifically with China, was one of his calling points, that he thought it was unfair.
Part of making America great again.
Part of making America great again. And really since March is when the trade war has heated up. And really, and this is all the White House pushing this against several countries, but China in particular.
Yes.
So where we are now is first, $50 billion of goods from China were targeted for tariffs. And just this week, another $200 billion. And China has reciprocated.
On equal numbers, equal amounts?
Well, actually, not in equal amounts because
it really
China doesn't,
can't be.
They don't import as much as we do, which is why President Trump thinks he can win this trade war. Just the simple fact they export more than we do. So they have more to lose than we do. But so far, I would say there was one very small positive development that people are overlooking, I think. Both the U.S. and China had proposed 25% tariff rates on this latest batch, and the actual numbers are 10%, and in some cases in China a little bit less, but between 5 and 10. And the stock market has responded positively. We have on Thursday, Dow Jones Industrial Average closing at a record high. And one other thing in terms of its impact on the U.S. economy, China's currency, the yuan, has depreciated, and it roughly by the same amount as these tariffs have gone up. So the dollar's extra strength has pretty much offset the impact so far of the tariffs. However, the U.S. did say if they can't come to a resolution that they will increase the tariff rate to 25% on January 1st and target an additional $267 billion of goods from China. And I think if that were to happen, that would hit a lot more products. And I think finally the U.S., certainly the U.S. companies, if not U.S. consumers, would actually really start to feel the pain, and it would put a big impact on the U.S. economy.
I want to ask you, Linda, is this a let's expand the circle a little bit, and let's talk about the other fronts where the Trump administration has taken on economic battles. We have the European Union. Mm-hmm. We have NAFTA. When you look at all these things and take them in their totality, is this more political strategy than economic policy? Is this a winning strategy really for the Trump administration? As Steve said, it's part of the Make America Great thing, and President of the United States, not of the world. But is it a winning policy and strategy?
So the gamble is that it is, at least through the midterms. So, and we're seeing, you know, if you talk to voters out in the country, Trump supporters, we're not seeing them leave Donald Trump, even among voters who are directly impacted by these tariffs. You talk to farmers and they say, yes, I'm feeling it, but I still like what he's doing. I like that he's shaking things up.
So they're so good.
They're with him. Right. So they're with him for now. And it also has to be pointed out that it kind of is an insurance policy against failure. The administration is providing $12 billion in farm aid to ease the pain in rural America. So they're not really taking it and going out of business. They're still in business, but the administration is helping them. The business community is not happy. I hosted an event this week with the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahue. Mm-hmm. Normally, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce would be a full-on ally with the Republican White House, but this White House is different, with a more populist bent. The Chamber of Commerce is more mainstream establishment Republican. They like to do business. They don't like tariffs. They understand the underlying reasons for these tariffs, the unfair trade practices from China, the stealing of intellectual property. But they think Trump isn't doing this the right way. So they're in constant communication, and I don't know that they can really influence him all that much, but they at least can make their case.
To make their case for that, correct. Quickly, last point on this one. Steve, what does a win look like for either side?
Well, that's actually a great question, because I think for the president, I think tariffs are the win. And I think this is a division within the White House that some of his aides say tariffs are a means to an end. And I think for others, tariffs are the end. It's just having less business with China, more domestic production is the win. So there's, to me, it's a real open question whether there's anything that China can realistically give, and there are certainly, you know, huge, very legitimate issues, but I'm not convinced the White House is really seeking concessions so much as wanting tariffs.
And all the, I guess, the voices on the other side against tariffs have left the White House, to my
Well,
account,
no, they haven't. I mean, there's been some replacements. So instead of Gary Cohn, we now have Larry Kudlow. There are still, and Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, is also, I would put, in the camp of wanting tariffs to get to a trade deal. But there are other of his advisors, certainly at the USTR and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who I think want a harder line. And I think they would prefer for the tariffs to be implemented and for businesses to have to choose where they're producing their goods and services and trying to get them to move to the United States.
Did you have a point on that?
No, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Let's talk about the Korea summit. Again, in this remarkable development, the North and South Korean leaders got together and made some declarations that moved the peace process between those countries along further and made incremental progress towards denuclearization. I think one was more addressed than the other. Steve, I'll stay with you on this one. Did you have a look at that? And what do you think were the major takeaways from this particular meeting?
So I think the major takeaways are that this very nascent peace process with North Korea, between North Korea and South Korea, and also with the U.S., they are continuing. I don't know how, you know, every kind of agreement that's been made has been on the most broadest of levels. I mean, there are no detailed agreements really for anything. Mm-hmm. But you do still have the talks, and you have the optics are incredibly positive.
Yeah.
You had the two leaders raising their hands together, you know, so the optics of it all are very positive. You have Kim Jong-un wanting another face-to-face meeting with President Trump. So you have all that, and you also have a certainly a lack of war, which is what we had last year when North Korea was lobbing missiles kind of in every direction. Right. We don't have that right now. So I would say to the critics of Trump's policy there, he can turn around and say, look, I haven't really given up anything other than the fact my prestige of being the president. And in return, they're not sending missiles anywhere. I think on the other side, you would say, well, you've given Kim time and it's not clear you've gotten any results at all.
But I have to say that I underestimated the North Korean leader, Kim. I have found him to be a very savvy negotiator. Mm-hmm. I think he's really understood the way that he needs to talk to his neighbor in the South and to President Trump. Would you agree? And how do you characterize this whole dance that he's doing?
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting. I mean, the stakes are high for everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, for President Moon of South Korea, this is just huge. I mean, he's really staked his presidency on this, on improving relations with the North, with easing tensions, working with the neighbors, working with China, working with and with the United States on the other side of the world. We're still in the beginning of this. I mean, we're heading into the United Nations General Assembly, and that, I think, could be fertile territory for more discussion. But we're really, I think, still in the beginning phases of this. Everything is very vague. It all sounds good. Donald Trump likes to come out and make grandiose statements about we've achieved denuclearization, but we know that's not true. The concession that he made to end the exercises with South Korea, that could end with the snap of a finger. So, you know, I'm optimistic because I choose to sleep at night, but you know, I like when there are not missiles flying over Japan and heading toward the west coast of the United States. But I think we need to just sort of wait and see.
Yeah, I love the fact that they're talking about a full-on peace agreement and a cessation of hostilities between these two countries. This is a war that's going on for 60 years.
Right, but another thing to bear in mind is here the United States is at the beginnings of a very major, serious trade war with China, and we need China on the Korea situation. So Trump, in a way, is working at cross-purposes with himself.
It really is the last word on...
I think that's actually a great point. And I would only add that at the beginning of his administration, he took the opposite stance. Remember, he had promised on day one to call China a currency manipulator. They didn't do that. He said, hey, in the early stages, he sort of gave some slack to China on trade because he wanted progress in North Korea. And now he's taking sort of the exact opposite approach.
So for one final issue that is, in a way, even though it's in a war zone, a little bit of good news, the leaders of Turkey and Russia said on Monday that they had agreed to create a demilitarized buffer zone in Syria's Idlib province to separate the Syrian government troops from rebel forces, with Turkish and Russian soldiers patrolling the zone to ensure it is respected. And Russian President Vladimir Putin, speaking after talks with the Turkish President Erdogan, said that all heavy weapons would be withdrawn from the zone and that quote-unquote, radically minded rebels, including the Nusra Front, would have to pull out of the zone. And that comes into effect, I believe, October 15th. I count this as good news and a life-saving, you know, type of agreement there. And my question is, does this make Russia a permanent player?
Well, that's the goal. I mean, Russia is very, very much interested in being a player on the world stage. And so the question is, can this agreement last? And I think there are geopolitical alignments that favor this continued alliance between Turkey and Russia in Syria. Russia has an interest in keeping Turkey on the side to secure Moscow's broader ambition of establishing itself as an important player, regional player, even beyond the Syrian border. So I think there are kind of geopolitical reasons why this could last.
Yeah, and I think that Turkey has once again, as it has throughout history, inserted itself as a keystone in the relations between East and West, and in this case, Washington and Moscow.
Right.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.